Thanks, everybody. Leo, Kevin, Jared, the group. It's great to see. Seems like more chairs out here this week. I hope that's a good sign. I say this before every meeting. These handouts are by no means everything. This is just some tidbits, some quotes out of the book to follow, some important information that I have found, and some thoughts of my own. So this is strictly my own experience here, okay? I am not, nor do I understand anyone to be an expert of any sort in AA. And how can I be? My spiritual quest is mine, and yours is yours. Okay, so what is significant to me may not be as much to you. However, the front page, and we'll get to it tonight under Freedom and Change, is a little summary that I wrote. But we're not going to get to that because we've got to pick up where we left off last week. And I'm trying to have these handouts so that you can not worry about looking up a page and finding that sentence or what have you, so we can all kind of be present here. And thanks to the great insight of the group to have the set-aside prayer that, you know, we're all here and as present as we can be, including myself. And so we're starting on step five, the beginning of chapter six, into action. And I'm here to tell you that if we skip this final step, we may not overcome drinking. Invariably, they got drunk. And that was me. And after 5.5 years of so-called sobriety at the time. And I say so-called because I had done steps. I had done multiple four steps. I had done three fifth steps. Made some amends, you know. And then kind of cruised, and my ego remanifested itself. These got out, and I started to take credit for all those things that started to write in my life. Okay, and it wasn't very long. Well, you know, maybe it was a year before I was out the door of the rooms, and then out for good. You know, I had a suddenly moment, but that suddenly moment was as a result of the shame, the guilt, the remorse over that one thing, that dark nook and cranny that our book tells us numerous times, minimum three times, that we must not skip anything. And I kept that one thing to myself. You know, my drinking, I was a real alcoholic. I was daily drinking at 19, 20. Those of you who were here week one and two, you know, I talked about that. Heading out of the military academy because I just, you know, I had to give it up. Drinking was already taking on a bigger proportion of my life at that time. But so many things happened. I ended up in so many places, did so many things that were pretty depraved. You know, so we all have them, you know, and, you know, White Lightning was one of my favorite drinks for a good period of my drinking. And I see a few heads bobbing. And, you know, White Lightning, when you do come to after a blackout, I'm a blackout drinker, so let's get that straight. And that's important going forward tonight, that, you know, a lot of my life is hearsay. Even when I tell my story, you know, I have to put bits and pieces together. And that's, so I don't forget it. That's a little something over here for the ninth step, because I actually get to relive and to really re-experience what I really was like when we go through these amends. And so, you know, I would wake up in various states. Like, I'd start drinking in Maryland and end up in North Carolina. Various states of undress, with clothes, without clothes, you know, in my yard, in someone else's yard, someone else's bed. You know, and I could have sworn it was Farrah Fawcett. I went home to, you know, the bar, you know, and it was Bozo the Clown when I came to. So we all have those things, you know, whatever it is for you. But the one thing that was the worst, I wasn't going to tell anybody, was my infidelity. Infidelity from, you know, like after 3 years out of a 25-year marriage. Okay? So that was the piece that I was most ashamed about. And that's what I did not tell in any of those fifth steps. And what do you think it was? Well, the book tells me about sprees. And it's not referring to just the drinking sprees. What happened? I went on a sex spree. I was living a lie in the rooms, sober, but my behaviors were absolutely not that of a sober man. And eventually that shame, guilt, and remorse again got me, and I had no choice because I had no God. I did not have a psychic change significant enough to recover at that time, and I drank again. You know, on 73, it says we only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. Yeah, I humbled myself a lot, you know, but not completely, not totally. And, I mean, that, there's nothing more significant than that I can tell you about a fifth step when not done fully, okay? So, having said that, I have the ability and the pleasure and the honor of sponsoring a lot of people and over the years, and, you know, I get to sit and listen, and what a huge responsibility. Our book talks about, and remember, it's written back when there weren't all these people in this room that maybe are available to sponsor, you know, in the beginning of the groups, and they were looking for who to go and talk to about this. But, you know, I have to ask myself, if I've chosen a sponsor or the sponsor's chosen me, however that has looked for you, if I'm hesitant about doing a fifth step, you know, I better take a look at myself first. But is that relationship strong enough to keep going forward in the work? Okay. As I said, it's an honor. So when I hear people say this, and there comes a point in that fifth step where you kind of sense when somebody gets edgy, and you can sense that there's something that's being held back. And that's usually the time then that I find it beneficial to put forward my deepest, darkest secret. You know, let me tell you what I did. And so often I hear, man, you were really weird. You know, or man, that's really messed up, you know. And that's good. Sometimes I may start the fifth step introduction, you know, with some of this stuff, with sponsees, you know. I don't just carry around a lot of paper anyway, just for the hell of it. I have to take notes. I'm not supposed to be holding on to this information that people are telling me in their fifth step. However, I need it at the moment to refer back to. I have a fourth step. I make copies of their fourth steps. So they keep the original and I have a copy. Because there's things that we'll find that are not consistent, you know. And I have to be able to refer back and forth to. So that's just kind of a little, you know, mechanical thing that I do with sponsoring some. You know, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. You know, and if we do, and if we are thorough, and if we are complete, then I think it's worth reading the promises, the fifth step promises. On 75, we're delighted. Man, it was a real load off my shoulders, I can tell you that, when I finally got 100% honest. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I'm not carrying around all those bad memories, all that guilt. Our fears fall from us. Yes, they do. They did. Do they come back? Oh, they can. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. Okay, the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. You know, so, I mean, those are pretty significant promises to me, that if I do this fifth step thoroughly and don't hold anything back, that I'm on my way to a spiritual experience. And so here we are on today's the handout. And this was something that, I'm not going to say it, but these books reference that I may use this quotation at the top of the page. We cannot teach people anything. We can only help them discover it within themselves, comes out of this book. So if you want to take a look at it afterwards. And... I I've used that, and I've talked about that with a lot of people, because I'm not going to want to know what I think I already know. You know, I'm not going to want to open up totally and fully. And so often, when we do discover stuff about ourselves, there is that impulse to maybe, whoa, I better just take it easy here and sit with this. No, I need to continue to go through it. You know, that is the key that I have found, you know, in doing this work. But this is all, you know, God, myself, you know, you all are crossing guards of life. You know, I'm going to talk about some people tonight that were such significant beacons of light in my life, both as mentors, then as friends, but also just at that first moment of when they were on the podium, when they said something that just my head exploded, that I had an experience that was totally out of my control. It just happened. And when those moments happen, I have to do something with it. And that's why I wrote here that discovery requires action. To take that action requires faith. Hopefully I have gotten to a place so far where I have these previous steps in my life and I have a foundation of faith. And the faith requires the grace which is always deep down within us that was told to us, a promise way back earlier into the book. See, these things are all connected. Every page, everything that we do in the book is connected. And I think after one lives in this book long enough over and over, it's not for the purpose of memorizing, it's not for the purpose of, you know, being able to, you know, brag or boast or I can remember this page or that. But, you know, I carry this little pocket big book everywhere. I mean, everywhere. And how do I know when a phone call is going to come? How do I know when somebody's going to call that needs help? Or I need help. And I need something to reflect on. I need some guidance. You know, I'm not thinking about what I'm thinking in my head. I am not an advisor. I do not give advice to people in AA, okay? That kills people. First of all, especially as a sponsor, I'm your sponsor. I'm not your marriage counselor. I'm not your accountant. I'm not your lawyer. And my sponsor, my first sponsor, told me, as a matter of fact, Robert, I am not even your friend. I think you're out of your mind. I wouldn't hang out with somebody of your sort if you paid me. And I thought, wow, man, bastard. Yeah. And he reminded me of this often in the first 3 months, you know. But one day, when I challenged him, and he says, how do you think I can keep an objective mind? And how do you think I can, you know, smack you upside the head and not care about our relationship? We're not having a relationship, Robert. I'm your sponsor. And I said, okay, all right, I get that. And, you know, it's not that friendships do not, you know, take place and all, but I have to be careful. You know, I am not supposed to get emotionally involved with my sponsees. Okay? How else can I best guide them? Okay? And that's, as I said, from my experience. So, we're moving in through our fifth step and into the next steps. And we have instructions after doing this fifth step about going home for an hour. And yeah, I'm one of those weird guys. I took my book. I don't have many shelves, but I put it up on a shelf. And I sat for an hour, approximately. And that's what I tell my guys to do, to go home and do that. And sit and get quiet and meditate. And if they're not at a place of meditating, just be quiet. Just think about it. The first five proposals, have you done them? Have you left anything out? It's up to you now, okay? In order for those promises that we read to have any chance of starting to materialize in my life, you know, I've got to have been as thorough and as honest as I can be up to that point. Now, that doesn't mean that there are things that I am not consciously aware of right now, tonight, sitting here, with regard to amends that maybe are out there that I don't know about. Okay? I'm not going to jump ahead. I want to stay in order here. But, you know, there's just, God's going to give me what I need when He, it, universe, you know, cosmic energy, when it comes, When it's given to me, it's given to me. When there's a teacher that appears, he appears, she appears. Okay? So, with what I've got, with where I've gone so far, to the best of my ability, and I'm answering to my satisfaction, the book says to our satisfaction, not to my sponsor's satisfaction, my satisfaction. Okay? So, this is kind of like the finale of our inventory stage there. Okay? And I have here written, though our inventory was critical and our story was humbling, we now move into action. For this is the only path described in our book to truly break free of ourselves, our thinking mind. Everything we think we know about us must go through this process of cosmic change, made possible only by God's infinite love and wisdom laid out for us in the following pages of our big book. And I write this only because this is my experience. This is the most succinct way I could think of trying to say this to you in preparation for step 6 and 7, which I think is a huge mistake for people to think that just because they're a paragraph each, that they're any less important than any other step. Okay? We do not create our changing self. I do not do it. God does it. God changes us through these disciplines. Another word for that is our design for living. Okay? Resulting in our newfound freedom. And how free do we want to be depends on our commitment and actions involved in our steps. The thoroughness with which I do these steps is going to determine just how potent a spiritual experience that I'm going to have. Step 6, am I now willing? Well, I'm only starting to consider am I willing enough because, all right, now I'm at step 6. And when does this happen? Well, fairly quickly after I've completed the review of the fifth step and the first proposals, the first steps, you know. And for me, I was in a place of really searching for the sky in terms of sobriety, okay, because I had started to been set free to such a degree that there was nothing holding me back, okay. And because I had the experiences of not being thorough, of relapsing, pain of 10 years, destruction of so much in my life, I was extremely desperate. Okay? And a place of desperation is usually really fertile ground for inspiration. You know? I mean, our book says an alcoholic has to be pretty badly mangled. Okay? And sometimes that's in sobriety too. Sometimes that is in the effect of these steps on me, okay, that it really is extremely profound, okay? It really is sometimes something that I can't really put into words. I often I stop people that are trying to explain to me what they're going through. You know what? That's you and God. Okay, if you can't find the words, or if you're trying too hard to put it into words to describe for me to understand, I don't have to understand the exact mechanics of your spiritual experience. You know, we usually can see it in each other's eyes. We always can see it in each other's behaviors. Okay, inside and outside of these rooms. Okay, so I stress that. Of course, we want to talk about these things with some folks, but there was an awful lot of stuff that just happened, to me in solitude and in quiet, which was a place that at this point I was just starting to get quiet. I was just starting to dabble in the waters of meditation first time through these steps. And my sobriety date is June 1st, 2004. So we're talking about I didn't start really doing the book until about 5-6 months. So within 6 months' time, I had all of this happen, you know, the first time. But step 6, I this is constant prayer and consideration that can God take away all of these, every one of them, over and over, 3 times again, all, every one. I heard Sandy Beach do a great bit at a retreat and talked about, well, now, you know what? If I ask God to take away 100% of my lust, I'm really not going to be much of a man, am I? I'm not going to really, you know, how am I ever going to get a date? You know, right? I mean, if I have no lust in my heart at all, what am I going to be? I might as well be a monk. You know, of course, this is the alcoholic mind. You know, or if I'm, you know, maybe deciding celibacy is a good thing to do here in sobriety. You know, oh my God, this is going to be it for the rest of my life. I'm never going to have another relationship. All right, God, I tell you what, I'll give you 80% of my lust. Let me just keep enough that makes me attractive. So I think. You know? So I think, you know. And greed, of course. I mean, greed over the top is too much. But, you know, I'm a businessman. I mean, I gotta get in there and mix it up. I got to win. I got to fight. I got to get to the top of the financial market. I'll take 25% of my greed. I'll give you 75%, God. No, that's not how it works. Okay, it's all. Now, but I have to feel that sense of desperation with regard to each of these character defects. And that's why I put this little chart in here. Because this is just something that I do with fellas. Because, okay, we've done our inventory, we've dumped and set everything in the fifth step, we're now considering, you know, okay, God, take away all my character defects. God likes to hear us. You know, like, stop, pray, even if I'm not at a point of meditating it, and pray. Well, what am I praying? God, please remove all my character defects. Okay. How about some specifics here? Okay? Because we know in everything we do, in all of this writing and inventory and later on, in nightly review and all, why are we are undisciplined people? We let God discipline us in these ways. Be specific. Write it down. Write these character defects. Have my character defect list in front of me and pray with my eyes open saying, God, remove this, this, this. Okay? Because a day, a week, or a year, or whatever it says, I'll forget this stuff. Not just what I did while I was drinking. I'll forget this stuff. I'll forget my behavior. So if I just put a long list of my character defects, and I just tell fellas, you know, Monday for the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I just check it off when it pops up. That's all. I start real lighthearted, okay? You check it off, okay. When they see this after a week, any time longer than that, maybe, it's overwhelming. They see that they're willing to have them removed, but they're here all the time, every day. You know? Then we might go to the next phase of the chart, say, okay, now next week, I want you to write just a bullet point when it happened, how it happened, who did it happen to, yada, 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 yada. And it's glaring so that they get to a place of saying, of feeling desperate again, desperation, of saying, oh my God, I can't do this. I'm really trying to focus and not be dishonest, but you just told me, you know, it took you 3 hours to drive home because of traffic, and it was only two because I saw you pass me on the way, you know, coming home. Little things, omission-wise, things like that. You know, I think we all go through phases, I know I did, of where, you know, cash register honesty, oh, you gave me too much change the first time I walked out. And then I said, oh, I shouldn't have done that. The next time it happens, I give it back. And then I'm so proud of myself, I tell somebody about it, right? Okay? All right? And it evolves. That, to me, is just a real simple example of the educational variety of spiritual experiences. Okay? It goes on like that. And that's how it was for me for a period of time. But at this juncture, at about a year sober now, okay, I was dumped on the doorstep of AA by God. I had first going through experiences with these steps. My life was in shambles. It got worse when I got sober. And the relationship was falling apart. The marriage was falling apart. Now, obviously, I had done enough to destroy it, but I got sober and I didn't realize that my wife was alcoholic too. And so now she's getting worse. And now I am experiencing everything that I made her experience as far as this alcoholic being the tornado roaring through her life and the life of my children, okay, who at the time were 16, 19, and 21, okay? So they're old enough. They know what's going on. They've seen the bottom, my bottom. They've been there, witnessed. And anything I'm trying to do to bring the spiritual way of living into my household is not working, as far as I'm concerned. And when I say I experienced the shoe on the other foot, I mean, I ended up in our sister fellowship, and it saved my life, because I then realized what I had done. Okay. And at that moment, and the event that I just kind of give it a summary statement here, because this is how it happened for me, my seventh step experience. After saying the prayer often, which is, you know, if I'm at the seventh step, if I'm really, I'm fully willing to have God remove these, but there might still be some doubt, I'm working this prayer into my daily practices, my daily life. And so at a moment of unbelievable, I just, everything was going wrong, let's just say, all right, I had to have this experience where I had to feel helpless at such a deep level that I had to resurrender all of these character defects, because now I had experienced the other side of my character defects, what they did to people. I now was experiencing some of that back, and I was utterly hopeless, utterly. The words I spoke was, God, I don't ever want to treat another human being the way I have treated my loved ones till the day I die. I can't take it. I can't take what I've done to these people. And I was sobbing uncontrollably at the foot of the bed, you know, humbling myself before God. And in an instant, that's all I can explain. In an instant, I was calm, breathing normal, a warm glow kind of felt, and I was breathing normal, you know. But I want to talk about depth and weight. That was my seven-step experience, that I had tasted the destruction of everything that was loving in my life around me and what I had done to it. And it was totally spinning out of control. Of course, I knew it was out of my control long before that. But anything that I was attempting to do at that time in bringing a healing environment to my family was, it was having the opposite effect. It was pushing everybody away. And after that experience, you know, I mean, I got busier in AA, you know. Now, I started to take commitments. I took a GSR commitment, you know. Now, usually the service manual says 2 years, but I was going through steps. Nobody else in the group knew anything about service outside the home group, and I started to get busy there in Orange County. You know, I was traveling to meetings. I was traveling to Vision for You in Union every Thursday, and Spiritual Awakenings in Burnettsville, New Jersey on Tuesdays. And I was meeting guys and gals, and it was a powerful, it was a different place. It was a different energy, okay? People who are really into this, who are really doing the seeking and trying to live this and being really accountable to each other, there's just a vibe in the room. There's an energy that it's undisputable. And so I was attracted to that. I mean, that's it, basic. I was attracted to that. It didn't matter that, you know, I was going to meetings in my hometown up in Warwick and all, but it was doing what it, enough, a little maintenance, I guess, for me. I'm supposed to be working with others, and I'm doing that and involved in the group. But where the juice was at these groups, where people were talking in lockstep about these experiences through this book. And everybody would step to the podium and they would have tremendous stories. And I don't mean drunk alarms. I mean tremendous stories with the steps, with the process. And I wanted that. And I knew I was having it. You see, because the effect of my experiences were very, to me, it was really powerful. I had my 8-step inventory list. I'm making amends, okay? God has been very, very good to me. So why the heck wouldn't I want God with me every step of the way through these amends? One of the last things I did out of desperation in the family situation, and I'm not going to get into, do you do a three, you know, do your hard amends, the ones you'll never make, the easy ones, I just write them down. I'm old fashioned, just put them down, we'll sort them out later. You know, I'm not in the computer, I'm in the handwriting. You know, there's something about my own handwriting. That's the way they used to do it. They didn't have computers and all of that, you know. It's more personal. It's like a letter to God. And I started making amends. And at that bottomless pit, though, I realized God, you know, was going to do for me what I knew I could not do. I'm not going to work on my character defects. You know, he's going to remove them. How's he going to remove them? I don't know. Doesn't matter. He'll do it. I believe that. My job is get busy, get useful, you know, work with others. And I did that. But one of the last things of desperation for my family I did was to orchestrate an intervention for my wife. Now, this is a few months later. This is an example of amends. I had to go up to college to pick up the two boys who were up at college upstate New York and bring them down for a 4-hour sit down with the professional that was going to go through. This was the preliminary. And we're in there. And we're in there with my pastor also. And there were other people involved at a later date. And hours into it, this professional said, "Well, Rob," he says, "I think you probably have a few things you want to share with your boys." And I made my amends right there. I told them. I said what had to be said. I didn't say I'm sorry, and I say that in my notes. You know, this is regret for, you know, behaviors past and how I've harmed you all. And I went through all of that. The specifics are not important here in time restraints. But they slept the whole 3.5-hour ride home to the college, you know, 3.5 hours down, 3.5 hours home. And when they got out, they said, "Dad, we love you." And all I thought the whole way home was, "Oh, they're never going to talk to me again." Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of talk said after I said what I did. A different kind of amends, you know. I mean, I asked them the questions. Let's not forget the two questions. You know, is there anything else that I've done to harm you that I'm not aware of? You know, and of course, how can I make this right? And they said, "Well, Dad, one thing's clear. Now at least we know. We always had the argument that we didn't know if you were in the mob or the CIA." And I said, "How's that, guys?" And they go, "Well, you know, Dad, you kept kind of strange hours. You're always out the door in the middle of the night. You know? Yeah. We think we're fooling. You know? We think we're sliding by." The point of that amends is not to wait, because 2 weeks later we had that intervention with my wife, and it went terribly bad. And that was on a Saturday, and on the Tuesday night before Thanksgiving, life was pretty insane at my house, and the boys had tickets to go to a concert, and They pledged they'd stay home, you know, and we'll work this out. I go, "No, you guys go. You have a good time, you know. Blow it out, and we'll get back to work here tomorrow. You know, Thanksgiving's coming up." And my oldest boy didn't get home that night. Luckily, they split up, and my oldest boy Trevor fell asleep at the wheel, stone cold sober, 5 miles from the house. On the Saturday morning of the intervention, I called my spiritual advisor and I said, you know, whatever happens with this thing, I know this is really where I'm at with my faith and with really truly believing. And little did I know that that experience was just a stepping stone to what I was going to have to go through and experience, you know, 4 days later. The point of that is, how dare I hesitate on making amends? Okay? The blessing to me is for me, because if I had not made those amends, my life would not be what it is right now today. And I can't tell you, as a result of that, how many amends I have made. I work, I save money, I buy plane tickets, I go places, and I go to Spokane, Washington, and make amends to a man who's 88 years old, 44 years sober in AA, 44 years drunk. One of the few people who stood by me back in the day, and make amends to him, and get home, and 3 weeks later he has a heart attack. You know, how dare I not push forward on these amends? Because I go make amends to one of the women who used to work for me and who left because she, you know, saw the writing on the wall, was very loyal. And when I sit down with her, now I had hesitated. I'd made contact. I mentioned the three A's: make the approach, the appointment, the action. You know, I contact people. I find them out, approach them, you know, feel it out, make the appointment. They're going to tell me when I'm going to make the appointment and how. Okay? Not on my terms, on their terms. And then I'm going to just take the action and do it. So I waited a month or two between phone calls, and this went on for 2 or 3 months. And finally then she says, well, next month we'll have lunch. Okay, I do this. And I sit down with her at the lunch table. And I say, you know, Millie, I said, I'm here to make amends because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous now, and I'm an alcoholic. And she goes, oh, you don't have to tell me anything about alcoholics. She says, My brother died of alcoholism, but the autopsy said he shot himself 10 months ago. 10 months ago is when I started searching her out. Now, I'm not responsible for that death by no means. Okay, that would be a pretty big ego. But what if I had moved, taken the action, when that thought, when that person's name came to me and went on a new 8-step list, which is always continually a new 8-step list, new people coming up and popping up, and I moved on that right away, maybe I'd been at that place to be of service. You know? I don't hesitate today anymore. I went on vacation recently, 3 weeks ago, to California, go back to my old stomping grounds, do some surfing. And so with that, I'm thinking about the past. I'm telling some stories to my partner, Kathleen. And I start thinking about Melanie. You know, it was like the dead mother to us when we were a bunch of wacko 18, 19, 20-year-olds. You know? Drinking for weeks and tripping on end. Okay? She was the face that I always seemed to see when I came out of a catatonic state in an ice cube bath. You ever had one of those? Okay? She was always there. And I started to think about that. I said, my God, of course I missed her. Of course I never thought about her. I had no resentments or anything toward her or anybody out there at that time that was trying to help me. And I started the search. Well, actually, the search started as a result of some other people in Miami last year that I went to. And I'm not a computer person. I told you that. Spacebook is what I thought it was called for a long time. So I have my Al-Anon black belt partner in crime set me up on Facebook solely for the purpose of making amends. I locate some people, so now I got the courage, the faith, and I'm going to try to do it again. And I get some pictures, I get somewhere, but I get a dead end. And I have an address 2 towns down the beach. And we're out there. And I prayed and meditate that night. I wrote a letter to what I thought was either her husband or ex-husband. I didn't know. And I was prepared to tell him what mission I was on. We always tell what we're doing, okay? That's in the approach, I should be to saying that. I shouldn't be waiting necessarily till I get to the front door. But anyway, I ring the doorbell, and she comes to a side door because she was sitting almost half on a deck because 6 years ago she had a stroke and she could barely talk. You know? But any links. I stole from my company. I stole from my father, who was the boss.
I stole from that company for a long time. I didn't take a dime in raises or bonuses for 6 years into sobriety to pay off a six-digit debt. Would you know when that six-digit debt was paid off? I said, okay, now I think I've paid it off. It's time to, I'll take that raise that I think I deserve after giving to the help person. And the first paycheck came in January that year, and there was no increase. So I turned to my office manager. I said, we had a conference. You know, didn't I say, you know, we all get the same percentage this year? She goes, no. I said, are you sure? She goes, call, you know, Rodney, my accountant. I called Rodney. Rodney, didn't we sit down and when we figured out, did I say, he says, I've been telling you for 6 years to take a raise, you stupid, you know, so-and-so. He says, you and your AA stuff. He says, no, you didn't. I wasn't done making the amends. Thank you, God. You know, my memory served me that I had the conversation and that it was time. So one more year. My father dies. Things were said. Amends were made. Things were said. And then when the will was read, guess what? I had to buy the company. The financial amends were not finished. I thought so, but they were not finished. And guess what? When those financial amends were done, those were my final ones. All the others were made before that. I got to tell you, I don't get to do stuff like this because I'm working 9 to 5 anymore. Okay? Life is pretty good. I work hard. And Doug M. If anybody's stuck on amends, I have one disc, one copy. Doug M. from Amelia Island, Florida. He's now in Virginia. I heard that man talk about amends and talked about making financial amends, talked about going to the state of New Jersey and being put in handcuffs. Okay, this guy I can call a friend today. And the first time I met him, he spoke from the podium. I heard his story of amends, and my head exploded. I had 5 names. I took a personal day the next day. I went to 3 states. I made all these amends, you know. It was like, you know, a Dr. Bob story. I came back at midnight, you know. And but when these things happen, you know, I've got to go with it. There was just something pulling me in it. 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens. All of these, the unexpected happens. I go on a dead tour of 14 shows in 2009. And virtually every city that I went to on the tour, I made an amends. I mean, obviously, if I'm following my own ideas here, I made these approaches and appointments before I went to Denver, before I went to L.A., before I went to San Francisco. It just blew my mind. And what were the amends that I made on that in Denver? The enemy. Why did that Bill write that the enemy is the first example? Now, I'm not saying we're supposed to go out and do the toughest one first. It didn't work that way for me. 5 years in, I'm still holding the resentment because I now work for the company, but I don't own the company. I screwed up so bad, I lost the company. You know Jim, our car salesman in our book? Okay, right? So here's the man I hated. Here's the man who destroyed me. Here's the man that, you know, threw me breadcrumbs so I get a paycheck, but someone else signs it for me. Okay. I had to search him out and go, I know where he is. Oh, he's a big kahuna. He's a giant in our industry. And I call him up. I say, how you doing? This and that. Okay. And I mean, we were at war as competitors for 20 years. And then he bought the whole shebang, not my little company, but everything else. So it didn't matter. He didn't have to buy money. He just crushed me. But he did it because, as he said in my amends, he says, You were a loose cannon, Rob. We didn't know what you were going to do. There were too many people's jobs and things at stake to put this running this company into the ground the way you were going. And so I sat with him and I told him and I had to tell him, you know, Carl, I said, I slandered your name all over the place, every convention. I was backstabbing you every chance I could ever make. And he just chuckled. He says, well, so does everybody in the business, Rob. I know that. You know? He says, you don't have to worry about that. I said, no, I do. I can't do that anymore. I will not do that anymore. I will not talk about you behind your back anymore. You know, I will not gossip about you. And I told him my the whole resentment and everything that I had toward him, and that I knew somehow that I brought this on myself, but I just can't figure it out. And he told me exactly how the whole thing happened. And so, like I said at the beginning, that I'm going to find out big chunks of reality about myself. The reality about myself is what really sets me free. When we say, how free do we want to be? You know, I mean, just because I've said from the podium at least 3 times at different year periods, I've made all the amends I'm consciously aware of, that does not mean that it's not going to pop up again. You know? I want to revert back to... Oh, let's just finish with, for tonight, I want to answer this question here. Let's revert back to the alcoholic on page 82 is like a tornado roaring its way through the lives of others. Don't forget it, right? I mean, if I've got to review my inventory and I missed something, the fact that people don't love me and kiss my butt in sobriety, ooh, I'm sober 6 months or a year, or don't let me back in the bedroom for months at a time, I told you last week. 3 years in the back room, all right? So if you're a sponsee and you're crying after a month or two, you know, call me in 2 years. It's like, dude, this is, look at what you did. I go back to my 7-step experience at the end of the bed. Now, that's not the only one I had, but that's the one. I have a picture dictionary of my sobriety in my head in these moments. They're so powerful that's what I can relate back to. And when I read through the book and this tornado, I must remember, and I can still be like this today. It's called spinning. Has it ever happened to anybody? The thoughts in my head, I'm late for work. Oh my God, I forgot to call my daughter. Oh, I didn't get the flowers for Valentine's Day. Oh, that bastard customer didn't pay me. Zoom, 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 zoom. That's a tornado. The speed, you know, we're clocked at 100 miles an hour. It still happens. See, but this is what it looks like from behind my eyes. That son of a gun. Oh, I better slow down. I'm only doing 80. When I really was mad, I was doing 100 and driving dangerously with someone in the car, right? But now that I'm down to 80 and cruising and my heart's not palpitating, I think I'm a mellow dude. I mean, I have a passenger in the car, and she says, we're not going to go to the show. I feel nauseous. We weren't even in the car. It's because I was spinning. I can still be that tornado. And when she told that to me, for the first time in my sober life, I became really aware of how energetically I can affect other people around me. Okay? Sometimes even non-verbally. So that's something to consider, why I want to be free. What am I going to want to be free of? I want to be free of myself. I want to be free of the bondage of self. I want to be free to be able to have an experience with God that's going to now take me through this spiritual life. This is not a theory. We do have to live it. And yes, God makes the seeds grow, but I got to put the seeds in the ground. I got to hoe the soil. You know, I mean, there's stuff to do. We have to act decent. I have to not turn on the porn when I go to the hotel out of town. I'm sorry, guys. Okay? We just... No more. No mas. No mas. Okay? All these little things, all these behind closed doors, nobody's looking. Yeah. That's what I have to do. That's what I have to do if I really want to get free. And let's be clear. The 9-step promises, I'm not going to read them. But they are not the contemporary promises of AA as we hear in many of our meetings where they'll read them at the beginning and the end of the meeting. They're not the promises of AA. They're the promises of the 9-step. Halfway through. Okay? But I believe that they did not come true for me until I continued to the best of my ability all the way through. That's where I'll leave it tonight. And we'll have another great one next week. Thanks. Hi, I'm Robert. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
I do surf, and I said to Kevin that whether you like nicknames or not, you get them. I guess that was group conscious. So, hey, how's everybody doing tonight?
Good,
because I am floating.
I have had an experience of both coming into the sunlight of spirit, leaving it, not necessarily drinking, and coming back and into the sunlight of the spirit. And that's where we're at tonight, in the book and in my presentation. As I say each week, you know, these outlines that I've provided for you all is some guidelines, and that's all it is. If whether you read them or throw it in the top drawer, you know, it'll probably fall out a year from now at the right time. You know, that's how things kind of work. Or if you've got somebody or some friends you want to pass it on to. You know, even if one line or one notation from a page that, you know, might mean something or that you didn't see before, or, you know, I present something that, you know, might give you a kick, you know. Then it'll be useful. You know, it's by no means, no one's, I'm no expert, haven't been here, you know, haven't experienced life long enough, sober, in my opinion, to you know, nobody's an expert. But, you know, this, doing this workshop has taken me back through my steps, has given me another new experience, you know. So, I'm sure that if I sat down, you know, 6 months from now, these outlines might look a little different. However, they are, I do try to put in there some really vital facts. I guess that'd be the best way to say it. You know, it's quotation marks when it's, you know, out of the book, and it's not when it's my words. And if you have any questions on it, if it disturbs you, that's good. If you don't like what I have to say, that's good. You know, we can chat about that, share some experience, you know. If you've had the same experiences, that's good. And you're all going to be very fortunate to share in my 10th step tonight, because I put it right here on paper for you all to go along with me. And I'm going to start with, you know, the beginning of the front page, which, oh, about midnight Friday night, after, as I said, I had exited the sunlight of the spirit, and I'll tell you why and how in a moment. But the meditation that I had that night was brief and short and potent, and it was just turn all things into the Father of Light. And when I wrote that down, I was sitting in the front seat of my car down at the second annual Jersey Roundup down in whatever town in Jersey it was near the shore, I realized, well, I've heard that before. And of course, that's from Bill's story, you know. And I went back, boom, page 14. And then in further meditation the next day, this is what came to me. And it's a little bit ahead of the story here tonight, but I want to get it out of the way. Like an infant, we need to be fed, constantly staying close to or into the nurturing arms to be quiet, to quiet my unrest, my noise, my thinking mind. There is no bank account I can draw from, because without him daily, my bank account balance is nil to begin with. Spiritual nourishment is the act of seeking him daily, automatically lays aside. By seeking him daily, automatically lays aside my prejudice that I think I know enough or have experienced all I think I need to. This equates to spiritual intoxication or spiritual pride. One of the biggest fears that I have, I realize at moments like what happened on Friday, is that if I become one with God, then who am and what am I? That's the spiritual axiom, that I have to give up me to find me. The practices of steps 10 and 11 levels my pride and places me in a position of humility, surrender to that power that promises me safety and protection. The place of neutrality is peace and serenity. It's quiet, not noisy. So when life is noisy, when my head is busy, when things aren't working well, I'm not in the sunlight of the spirit. You know, I'm not peaceful whatsoever. And that's what happened Friday. And we were heading down to this roundup. And long and short, things did not go well during the day. Things were behind schedule, my schedule. I continued to work at my desk. I wouldn't put the phone down. I kept getting amped up. I reached for the coffee again. I already had one cup. We're going to get to that about coffee and me. I was getting really edgy now. I was starting to have some problems on the phones with people. It was just starting to spiral out of control. I could have put the brakes on any time. I work for myself today, you know, for the most part. I do have another part business that I have an employer. But I was driven to by Rob to complete these tasks that I thought, you know, nothing's going to go right this weekend unless I get this stuff done. You know, in the meantime, my partner Kathleen is, you know, doing her share, and I'm getting a little back at her. Okay, so now there's a little resistance there. Now I'm starting to cop a resentment there. We get in the car, Friday traffic, Parkway. Bam. Hour and a half ride took 3 hours. You ever notice that when you get into a place of disharmony, the decisions start going rapid fire, and they're all wrong? It gets worse. Okay? I could have pulled that car over at any time and stopped, said a prayer, you know. As a matter of fact, she's sitting in the co-pilot seat now. She started driving. You know, she's trying to point out positive stuff. I hate it when people get positive when I'm in a rut, you know? Because when I'm miserable, you better be too. You know? I mean, that's the way I used to be. That's by no means what I'm like even on a part-time basis today. What I am sharing with you is something that the last time an event like this happened to this degree, actually this degree was less, but in this category, rage, was 2.5 years ago. Okay? So it has a lot to do with what my meditation said here and about spiritual pride, you know. And I think that's key to remember what these steps, 10, 11, and 12, but especially 10 and 11 are for. And 10 kind of gets skipped over a bit. Okay? Continue to take personal inventory. Okay, promptly admit we're wrong. Okay, yeah, I do that. All right? And, well, what about the guy that continually, you know, he comes to me and he says, well, you know, I get angry at my girl, but I apologize right away. And this goes on and on and on. Okay? I just read something out of this book here, Emmett Fox, Sermon on the Mount. And it says, no, that's not true. That's not spiritual growth. Because, if I find it without wasting time. No. Basically, spiritual demonstration demands that anger itself be overcome. It is simply not possible to get any experience of God worth talking about or to exercise very much spiritual power in the way of healing unless and until you have got rid of resentment and condemnation concerning your brother man. This is a great book. I mean, we say the Lord's Prayer a lot, and it picks it apart. You know, it's one of Dr. Bob's favorite authors. And I'm going to refer to this book again, Dr. Bob's Library. You know, I highly recommend it. But so, this event, I'm raging, but it's not like I'm screaming, but I am inside, okay? I am just negative. I'm pissing and moaning. I'm yelling at the... I am road raging. You know, she's trying to be positive and bring me down. I'm getting more flustered, and she goes quiet, and I finally understand what's going on. Because that event 2.5 years ago, we were going to a show, we were going to a concert, and by the time we got to Coney Island to the further show, after about a half hour of silence, she says, "I cannot go in with you. You make me nauseous." Okay. There really is something about my vibe. There really is something about my energy that I walk around with, you know, all the time. And if I think that I don't affect people, well, let's refer to the tornado roaring through the lives of others, even sober. Okay? And you know what? I had a lot of shame associated with this that happened. We get there, we go out, she goes upstairs, we separate, we have to, I know, she needs space. And the first speaker, we were late, very late, missed the first speaker. Second speaker, Marie, from Ontario, Canada. 30-plus years talking about the insanity and the second step. She was there last year. Phenomenal speaker.
But what floored me was in the last few minutes, where she shared an experience after 30-some years, how, as she described it, with this one sponsee that she had been working with for 4 years, of which she was extremely, was very difficult. But she said, at one point I snapped. She says, and I took her inventory for the last 4 years, and I told her everything I thought. But, you know, like total taboo for a sponsor. And she did this and realized this woman was shaking, was crying, ran out of there and all. Well, Marie called her sponsor after the event, and after prayer, meditation and all, realized I have to resign as your sponsor. And that woman gave me the courage to start talking about what happened to me a few hours earlier, and then to put it down on paper here. Okay, because what happened the rest of the weekend, because I took these steps, I did this exercise that's at the bottom of the page, and it's right in the book. Okay, so let's look at page 84. Okay, and then I'll come back to, we're going to talk about actual meditation practices. Okay, we vigorously commence this way of living. We cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Not an overnight matter, must continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for. Watch. If I am an alcoholic of the real and hopeless variety, I am not going to remember a day, a week, or a month of the events the way they really are. My inventory proves that. That's why we write a lot. I do, you know, and people that I work with, I have them write a lot, okay? So I'm going to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's what it says. When these crop up, when? It doesn't say if or maybe, you know, next decade of sobriety, you know. It says when. It's going to happen, okay? Now, in varying degrees, of course. Okay, but when these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Well, I did not, and it kept getting worse. I just explained that to you. But now I'm at a place where, okay, I'm doing what I know I'm supposed to do, that I always do. Okay. I write these down. Okay. Now, before I go to we discuss them with someone immediately, I want to tell you how I do a 10-step, because this is, for me, a real simple segue into the 11-step.
I've already got it highlighted and underlined, you know, and then I do that set aside prayer, and then all of a sudden new information comes off the page where you go, whoa, that's big stuff. Surely that's only in the fourth edition, you know. Can I have my glasses? So, you know, I've had a really different experience with the steps after we met Mark and Chris and Myers and Bob D and some of my heroes in this program. And, you know, just people that were, you know, like I said, it turns out there was a level of this deal going on that I had never experienced. And so the thing we're looking at when we're studying the book at our group is what information did they, if they were able to put it all in, really basically the first 103 pages. I mean, the back chapters about, you know, to wives and the family afterward and to employers and the vision for you are critical chapters, and there's great stuff in there. But basically our whole recovery program is in about this much of the book. And if they were able to put our whole recovery program in that, what information did they find important to put in there, and in what order? Why are they saying this? And why are they saying it here? You know, what message are they trying to get across to me? Why are we talking about the jaywalker? Why are we talking about the certain American businessman? Why are we talking about the guy with the whiskey and the milk? Why are we, you know, and all these things? And what point are they trying to get across? And the amazing thing about it is, out of all that, this much of it that is, you know, the basic nuts and bolts of the recovery program, this much of it is on step one. Because, and why is that? Why do you think the book spends the doctor's opinion and the first 43 pages of the book trying to explain step one to me? It's because it drives everything. You know, I mean, I don't know if they say this, but when I came in, I heard people saying stuff like, well, you know, you worked the first step getting here. you know. And did anybody hear that? Did you hear people saying that? You know, and it's like, wasn't my experience. It wasn't Bill's experience. It wasn't Dr. Bob's experience. It wasn't Roland Hazard's experience. We get here knowing we're in trouble. But I've been knowing I was in trouble for a while. But I didn't know what it meant to be, you know, the books, when it says we have recovered, it, you know, because there is a, you can argue both sides of it. There's another place where it says we are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. But up in the front, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So when we're talking about this recovery, what are we talking about having recovered from? Because it didn't help me to know that I was alcoholic. I'd been kind of walking around, you know, knowing I was alcoholic for a while. I mean, I spent a good deal of time raising my hand in AA meetings saying, my name's Charlie, I'm an alcoholic, and I had no idea what it meant. I mean, now I figured if there was such a thing as an alcoholic, surely I must be one, because I didn't know anybody that drank more than I did, or, you know, I was not a mild case. I wasn't, you know, I hear people going, I told my family I joined AA, and they said, wow, we didn't even know you had a problem, you know, and I was like, nobody in my family said that, you know. I mean, you know, it was like, oh, thank God, you know. But I still didn't really understand what the deal was, and I had this first experience with the steps, but then when we came along, and I hit a bottom at 4.5 years, I hit a bottom at 7 years, and I hit a bottom at 17 years. And we're going to talk a lot about what the missing chunks were. I like to talk about the difference between my understanding of the steps that first time through and what my understanding of the steps is today. And I talk a lot about step one. When I sit down with a new guy, it takes me about an hour and a half to do step one, you know, if I've got a guy that's really paying attention. And that wasn't always the case, because I'd heard the stuff like, and none of this is ill-intentioned stuff or anybody trying to harm anybody, but I hear people saying nobody gets here by mistake, and, you know, you work the first step on your way to the treatment center and stuff like that. I didn't really get the true nature of this disease, and I've got a great, now, how long are you going after me?
Nobody.
I'm going to finish the whole night off here. Boy, it's funny. You'll see us fighting over the microphone. You know, I don't know if you got that in our story, but I mean, Katie and I were best friends, like brother and sister, for 20 years before, you know, and I knew her husband. I was at their wedding, you know, and I mean, there was no flirtation, no innuendo, zero energy like that. One of the first female friendships I'd ever had. She was really like my kid sister, so. You know, and then one day, you know, after Joe had died, she caught me in a weak moment and made a pass at me. But, you know, we've been a couple for 10 years. But, I mean, it's unbelievable. And some of our friends were just like, Charlie and Katie, you know, this will be interesting. You know, but you know, I talk a lot about step one. It's one of my favorite. And when we talk about a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, I always say step one experience drives everything in the work. And so I don't like to gloss over it. So when we talk about a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, what are we talking about? And the way Dr. Silkworth describes it, I like to say that as an alcoholic, you know what made AA a big deal when it came along was a clear understanding of three things, you know, that came together that made AA. It was an understanding of the problem, what my real problem is as an alcoholic, an understanding of the solution to that problem, and then a program of action that would bring about that solution. Because, you know, if I go out to my car and it won't start, let's say I don't know anything about cars, and I go out to my, and I stick the key in, and I'm turning it, and nothing happens, well, I got a problem, right? And I don't know what it is, okay? And let's say Brendan comes out, and he goes, oh, man, you left your headlights on, you got a dead battery. And I go, oh, okay, so now I know what the problem is, right? Am I getting ready to drive? I started saying, am I fixing to drive home? But I know you don't say that up here. You know, I should tell you, in Texas, fixing to do something means you're preparing to do something. It doesn't mean repairing. It's preparing. I'm fixing to go. I'm fixing to knock your head off. So now that I know what the problem is, I'm not fixing to go anywhere, right? Because I need a solution, right? And so what do I do now? Well, we got to get some juice in that battery, you know, because the battery turns the starter, and the starter is what fires everything off. Okay, got it. Now I know the solution to my problem. Am I getting ready to go anywhere? No, because what I really need is for Chris to come up and go, okay, now listen, raise your hood. I'm going to pull my car over here. I got some jumper cables in the back. We're going to put black on black, red on red. I'm going to rev my engine for a minute. When I give you the signal, turn your key. Now I've got a program of action that will bring about the solution to my problem. And the book is full of stories. It's really interesting as you watch the way they're weaving it in there. The book is full of stories where people had 2 out of 3. You know, like the certain American, Roland Hazard, Carl Jung knew what the problem was, and he knew what the solution was, and he says he got the money, but he didn't have a program of action. Dr. Bob knew he sensed that spiritual values would help us. I'm paraphrasing now, but he had the Oxford Group program of action. But it wasn't until Bill came and explained the problem to him. It says when the broker explained the problem to him the way the doctor Silkworth explained it to him, I'm paraphrasing again, the doctor sobered and went after this work with a new energy and that sort of thing. So it's a big deal when these three things come together. But when we talk about the problem, what are we talking about? As an alcoholic, I only have 2 problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it, and one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I really don't struggle with alcohol. And so the first thing we're going to talk about in the doctor's reading are Roman numeral 28, XXVIII. And this is a page that just needs to be worn out in your book when you're working with new guys. Dr. Silkworth says he had written a letter 4 years earlier putting this opinion forward, and he says that's what he's referring to when he says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Well, I like to break this stuff down because that's the kind of stuff that when I'm reading it, it just starts going wah, 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 wah. You know, and I think I know what it's saying. But when you break it down, he's saying that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics, so who are we talking about? We're talking about chronic alcoholics, you know, not candy-ass little 2 beers and oh dear, you know, I burned the toast, I better go to AA, you know, and stuff like this. Well, I got to tell you a story. This has nothing to do with anything, but I got bunny trails coming at me. I should tell you, I got a little ADD working up here, and there'll be times when I'm talking where I say we're going to get back to that later. And what that means is that this is not the appropriate time to tell you that piece of information. But I'll warn you that when I say we're going to come back to it later, we're probably not coming back. You know, I always get real excited when I actually circle back around to one. But we're, you know, because people so bad want to identify, you know, as that identification we're talking about, you know. But the best way to point out how important that identification is when it's not there. I mean, most of us, by the time we get to AA, it's not the first time the topic of my drinking has come up. You know, anybody else have a talent for getting drunk at exactly the wrong time? You know, right when people are starting to count on you again and it looks like, you know, things are getting in, you know, and they always ask that question. You know, they'd always go, why'd you drink? Why'd you do it? Why'd you drink again? And we'd give them the only answer we got, which is what? I swear to God, it's like a chorus. Everywhere you ask that question, the answer is, I don't know. I don't know. Jesus, God almighty, I don't know. I mean, it's just what I do, you know. And by the time we get here, I really am thinking there's something wrong with me, you know. Disease my butt. There is something mentally and morally wrong with me, because I know when I swear to God I'm not going to do this again, and then I do it again. You know, so that's what I want to talk about, is when we talk about, when he says the action of alcohol and his chronic is the manifestation, all manifestation means is the way something presents itself. Right? Let's say that this whole front row lays here and me, we all eat strawberries after the meeting, and everybody does fine, except for my throat starts swelling shut and my eyes start swelling shut. And you know, all allergy means is an abnormal physical reaction to something. If everybody else eats strawberries and they're fine, but I eat strawberries and I can't breathe and I can't see, and you have to call EMS and they rush in and they give me a big shot of Benadryl and it looks like I'm going to be okay, you'd say this guy's got an abnormal physical reaction to strawberries. Does that make sense? So what's in the manifestation of it is that swelling and not being able to breathe and that sort of thing. So it says that the manifestation, now what is the manifestation of my allergy to alcohol? See, I'm also allergic to poison ivy. Anybody else allergic to poison ivy? Well, you know how it manifests. If I get in poison ivy, I get a rash. It itches like crazy. If you scratch there and scratch somewhere else, you get it. That's the way it manifests. So it says that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving, here's where it gets interesting, is limited to this class. There's really only a couple of places in the book where it really gives me a test for alcoholism, and this is one of them. It says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class. What class? It's a class of chronic alcoholics. Right? And it says, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never is not very often. You know? I mean, it's my sister doesn't react to drinking like I do. Right? Never will. She's not alcoholic. She doesn't have this thing we're talking about. I know I could pour enough vodka in her to get her drunk. I could put her behind the wheel of the car and she could get a DWI. In fact, I mean, would you be willing to admit that there's probably somebody